Paper 5, section 4, which is old single column, page 66. Let's see here. We need an intro. I don't think so. You'll see where they're kind of shifting a little bit here. Maybe one thing to notice as we start reading into this, notice how much they're appealing to a lot of logical recognition and deductive reasoning. I mean, there's a lot of precision structure to the conversation as they go forward here, that's very intentional. Because they're trying to encourage true religion, which has to exist in the full picture. You can't just have the unity consciousness. You need your individuality consciousness going as well. So, God and religion, and they're working hard, sort of between the lines, to set a frame of mind that isn't so fuzzy. They're trying to encourage. Bringing a lot of precision of relationship into your thinking about religion. You scan and you start seeing numbered lists and this sort of thing. So, let's just jump in. Who'd like to? You want to? Okay.
God and religion. The morality of the religions of evolution drives men forward in the God quest by the motive power of fear. The religions of revelation allure men to seek for a God of love because they crave to become like him. But religion is not merely a passive feeling of absolute dependence and surety of survival. It is a living and dynamic experience of divinity attainment predicated on humanity's service.
Just pause to note that they have the two italicized words there. And like we're working actively to do to when we're reading a sentence, think of ourselves first rather than that other guy that who isn't maybe quite up to speed. Always be looking for a little litmus test that you can apply to yourself. Here's a nice one here. You can ask yourself the simple question. Okay, so sense of religion. How does that feel? Does it feel like God is driving me, or that I'm drawn to God? Just ask yourself that simple question. It's like, wait a minute, I haven't thought about that. I know that all the history is, all of this thou shalt nots and very fear and all this. But what about, have I? When I think about God, do I, notice the motive force thing. What gets you to do something? Is it still fear that you might not be living up to God's expectations, even a little bit? Does that trickle in? Just catch yourself, is it the word, the first italicized word or the second one? But always when you're doing that, don't be unnecessarily hard on yourself. Don't expect yourself to have been born perfect. Just know that that's the challenge. You start out. Just as there is an evolutionary religion that inexorably must begin there, can't begin anywhere else except the zeroth level of meaning. That's where you start. It has to start there, and so do each of us. We have to start there. You can't start anywhere else. And the challenge is just to begin to create a nice gradual transition within yourself from being driven to being drawn.
The great and immediate service of true religion is the establishment of an enduring unity in human experience, a lasting peace, and a profound assurance. With primitive man, even polytheism is a relative unification of the evolving concept of deity. Polytheism is monotheism in the making. Sooner or later, God is destined to be comprehended as the reality of values, the substance of meanings, and the life of truth.
Did you notice a little something at the beginning there that might have caught you off guard? That first paragraph ended in a way that seemed understandable. It is a living and dynamic experience of divinity attainment predicated on humanity service. Yeah, you hear that word service, especially they stick the word humanity in front of it, and it's like, okay, I know what they're talking about. Did they catch you off guard a little bit? They turn right around and say, the great and immediate service of true religion is the establishment of an enduring unity in human experience, a lasting peace and a profound assurance. Okay? So, as you're going out motivated to serve, is that what you're trying to foster? Are you feeding the soul or the belly first? The great and immediate service of true religion, yeah, is that establishment of an enduring unity. That's supposed to be what religion has its basis in, that recognition of the unity that's in the universe. Not the individuality, that's the basis for science. That recognition of the unity and the recognition of the value of that unity, the purpose of that unity, and how much every individual needs a relationship to that unity. And from the religious point of view, first and foremost, they need that first before they need, issues of self-maintenance or, whatnot. That's supposed to be what religion is bringing in to the civilizational mix.
It goes so well hand in hand, I think, when you go out and serve your brothers and treat them like brothers. You don't even have to say, I'm treating you like a brother. Mm-hmm. You just behave that way.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's going to be you're going to have a subtler thought in your mind. It's going to take wisdom and grace and graciousness and, to try to foster this element of civilization.
I was talking to someone tonight, and they were talking about how they've been dealing with thoughts of death, and it's just more of a hopeless life.
Each of us, is an individual. It's just a fact. It doesn't matter how much you haven't thought about that, or pretended that that wasn't the case. But there's a thing that inexorably brings that thought into play. It's looming death. That will bring, the fact that you're an individual very sharply into focus. And if there's no unity associated with that individual, that's can get pretty lonely and empty. That's what we're talking about here. I mean, the great and immediate service, see? That's what people need, really, really need. Now, so you got some of those big things in play, but then they start bringing in. We've got sequences, we have lists here, and so sooner or later, in other words, it's just an inexorable part of how the system is set up. Sooner or later, God is destined to be comprehended as the reality of values, the substance of meanings, and the life of truth. If that's three very basic facts about God, can you think of the correlation? We have little expressions that tend to indicate the basic facets of the nature of God. Can you associate those? Reality of values. You have values, it is spirit, substance. Okay, but the reality, in other words, when purpose is imposed upon that substance, and pattern. He's given pattern. He's the reality of values. Oh yeah, God is personality. That's one of those pithy little statements of nature, on the nature of God. God is, sooner or later, God is destined to be comprehended as, you know, a person. God is personality. Okay, the substance of meanings. Okay, things, meanings, values. Okay. You know, like we always talk, you know, we have two substances with an energy that relates them. Mind relates the two substances of matter and spirit. You know, you might have a vague notion that there's something that meaning is going to. And starting, you know, if nothing else is starting with this thing, you, and you have this sense that there's a meaning stemming from that, and you know, in some sense that it's going somewhere. You know, we know that meaning is a relationship between things and values. I mean, and that's a quality of a substance. There is a substance at the other end of meanings. It's something that meaning is reaching out and latching onto. It isn't just, you know, trying to somehow extend out indefinitely. It's reaching for something. You know, it's reaching for spirit substance. You know, sooner or later, God is destined to be comprehended as spirit. God is spirit. Okay? So the substance of meanings and the life of truth. Law is
life
itself. Yeah.
Law is life.
Life itself. Who can finish it?
Not
the rules of its conduct. Yeah. All right. Law is life itself. Okay. Law is life itself. Okay. The life of truth. God is law. Yeah. There's a law. There's a life. There's a truth. It isn't just some fuzzy, wishful word that, you know, is fun to use and say you're a truth seeker and all these groovy things and, you know. Law is life itself. Okay. So God is personality. God is spirit. God is law. You know, to get that very definitive factual grounding in the nature of God, you know, sooner or later, you know, that happens. And then you can build something powerful on that, which probably is where they'll get to very shortly. Okay.
God is not only the determiner of destiny, He is man's eternal destination. All non-religious human activities seek to bend the universe to the distorting service of self. The truly religious individual seeks to identify the self with the universe, and then to dedicate the activities of this unified self to the service of the universe family of fellow beings, human and superhuman.
Okay, a couple things there. Look at that great picture. All non-religious human activities seek to bend the universe to the distorting service of self. You know, you bend the whole universe around yourself. You're at the nucleus of everything.
Yeah. Welcome to the culture of
Satan. Okay. All right. So, you know, just one little simple case in point. A non-religious activity like science. Oh, wait a minute. Do I really want a science that reflects a theory of a universe that wraps around me at its center? Would that be true science? No, that would be false science. A self-centered physics would be a false physics. God has to be at the nucleus. No, you're not going to have true science. See, and that's, again, there shouldn't be any non-religious activities, really, you know, in the full true sense. It should be true science, true philosophy, true religion, all together in one threefold unity of harmony.
It's a selfish origin, that desire of figuring out a perpetual motion machine. It's because inherent in that notion is the idea that I would have power if I could figure out a perpetual motion machine.
Can anyone tell me what the actual perpetual motion machine is? And not God. Think more literal. We no. Well, but that's the only thing in the universe is stationary. It doesn't sound like a perpetual motion machine to me. No, we just, there's two substances. Right? Spirit, substance, is self-animating substance. Perpetual motion machine. Okay? You know, that perpetual motion machine that is, that people have been seeking, you know, with this religious, like this quasi-religious zeal for, you know, the last 150 years, say. See, think about what's behind that. There is something that you can find and, you know, connect to that is a perpetual motion machine, and it will give you great power. You know, spirit substance. That's what you're looking for. Yeah. So, just, you know, if you just begin to put God at the center, you can start to see things in a totally different way. Turn notions like the search for a perpetual motion machine on its head. Okay? Notice the other little thing in there. Lots of fun little tidbits they're throwing in. Notice there was a construct where there was blank and blank there in that last sentence. The truly religious individual seeks to identify the self with the universe and then to dedicate the activities of this unified self to service. Yeah. Yeah. Does that remind you of a sequence we've often talked about? This twofold consecration. You know, when we talk about there's a twofold consecration, consecrating the mind to the universal harmony, consecrating the will to the perfect will of the Father. Okay, but what's the order we should think of that in? Okay, the order they just put them in right there. See, a truly religious individual seeks to identify the self with the universe, to consecrate their mind to the harmony of the cosmos, at least to an initial measure, and then purpose that. Don't purpose it before you've synced it with the harmony, because what are you purposing in? You're purposing discord. You're purposing, right? You know, you're going to ask, that leads nowhere you want to go. If there's a fundamental absence of unity, you know, in this mindful state that you're now going to purpose. That lack of unity is called evil. You've given evil form in your mind. And if you purpose that evil, okay, that's called sin. Okay, this is, it's not getting any better here. Okay. See, that's why they have them in that order. See, and then. It doesn't just say and, it says and then. Yeah. So that there's an order to dedicate, you know, the activities of this unified self. Don't dedicate the not yet unified parts of the self. Just dedicate those aspects that you know, are personal selves, you know, the reflection of harmony. You know, dedicate that to the service of the universe family of fellow beings, human and superhuman.
Yeah. Chris, there's a saying called, there's a will, there's a way.
Right, and you have to recognize the way and then will it. You know, the mother's a way, the father's a will. Remember they, you know, literally had that sentence that pointed that out up there in the Supreme Papers? You know, when you're finally getting to think about the Supreme and really getting the whole distinction between existential and experiential deity cleared up, and they say, you know, that whole will and way thing, let's get that properly. You know, there's the way, there's the hand that you are going to walk on, the actual way, and then there's the will along it. First the mind, then the will. Yep.
The domains of philosophy and art intervene between the non-religious and the religious activities of the human self. Through art and philosophy, the material-minded man is inveigled into the contemplation of the spiritual realities and universe values of eternal meanings.
Yeah, yeah, it's a vast conspiracy. You're tricked into it, yes, to get you going here. Inveigled is a fun word. You know, it's basically, you know, the literal sense is, you know, by trick you mean you can't see what's actually going on. Okay. you know, sort of the literal sense of inveigled. Yeah.
All religions teach the worship of deity and some doctrine of human salvation. The Buddhist religion promises salvation from suffering, unending peace. The Jewish religion promises salvation from difficulties, prosperity predicated on righteousness. The Greek religion promised salvation from disharmony, ugliness, by the realization of beauty. Christianity promises salvation from sin, sanctity. Mohammedanism provides deliverance from the rigorous moral standards of Judaism and Christianity. The religion of Jesus is salvation from self, deliverance from the evils of creature isolation in time and in eternity.
Okay, so before we do the great quote, let's notice, you know, what's behind what everyone chuckled at there. You know, so you've got that very nice little pithy sequence of, you know, the salvation notion in each of those, paths. And it's very important to notice that they didn't say Islam. Let's start with that. Important thing to notice as you read through the Urantia book is when they use Islam and when they use Mohammedanism. Okay? That's very purposeful. Okay? It's one thing to have something, you know, that, you know, it could be called Islam. It's another to have something that first and foremost is predicated on a guy named Muhammad and the ism that you've attached to that individual. Okay? That when they're wanting you to remember that there's this big issue in play there, you know, they remind you that there's a strong tendency for there not to be Islam but to be Mohammedanism. Okay? You know, and at best you'll have Mohammedans rather than Muslims. Okay? And of course we all know that there's a strong tendency to not even just have Mohammedans, but to have Mohammedanists. Radical. Okay? Okay. You know, the ism with the ists go with it. Okay? Okay, so that's the first thing. And this whole bit about, you know, providing deliverance from the rigorous moral standards of Judaism and Christianity. I always try to, you know, whenever this sentence comes up, try to remind everyone, you know, what's at the core of that. Don't think superficially about it. But what's at the core? What's the problem at the core that is stemming from this individual and the ism that's become identified with his name? The notion that there is no reality to the inner life, that there's only an outer life. Okay, and so think about what that means. If you reject the notion of an inner life in favor of just the outer life, okay, the temple within, the domain of the inner life, the second cosmic intuition is there in that space, the moral discriminations. I mean, you basically are eliminating the notion of moral consciousness, you know, not to mention logical consciousness and spiritual insight and everything else too, but we all know, and it's going to come up, you know, as we're reading about how morality is such a big part, you know, and evolutionary religion. Okay, so see, you're just rejecting that true notion of moral consciousness, you know, that's rooted in the inner life with the second cosmic intuition. Okay, well, you know, there really isn't, you know, just complete anarchy. So how does this work? What system do they set up? You know, if they're not going to challenge people to have the law written in their heart, you know, the heart, the temple, okay, to have that recognition of the second cosmic intuition, then what do you replace it with? Society. You replace it with mullahs.
With what?
Mullahs. Individuals who are said to have the connection to God. And you look to the mullah. So in the same way that you would look to the moral consciousness within, you look to the mullah without. Okay, you know, and you trust that You know, what you've been told, that there is a solid linkage between God and that individual, you know, so, you know, you can listen to that individual rather than trying to somehow hunt through the clutter of, you know, this whole notion of this rigorous trying to somehow peel all the selfish self-clamoring out of the way and try to somehow get at that. You know, just, you know, forget about all that. It's right there, clear as a bell, right in front of you. It speaks, you know, Arabic or whatever, you know, and just listen, and there it is. Okay, that's, you know, and so, and that of course is, you know, what probably the most problematic element of the ism, you know, that you're so actively not trying to sift through the clutter of self and clarify that you're just immediately surrendering that effort to some external fact.
I don't know if this is relevant, but as it says here, to, of course, either ignore the rigorous moral standard. Does that make sense?
Right, that's what I was saying. I mean, you can interpret it, you know, in that. I mean, that's one of the, you know, one of the basic things that should be. You know, I mean, we all know how much fixation on morality, you know, there is in Judaism and Christianity, you know, throughout history. You know, it's just like a, you know, obsession at times. Okay, and. You know, and they were, you know, so you can imagine a reactionary phenomenon to that obsession with just minutia, morality, you know, 500, you know, volumes of, you know, things you're supposed to follow and blah, 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 you know. Okay. I mean, okay, so obviously there's, but, you know, there's, that's not the big issue. You know, that's what I was saying. Don't just interpret that sentence with that obvious superficial element. There's a deep core issue that's really problematic, and that's what I was speaking to. You know, that they make it a sentence that's bound to either make you chuckle or bitterly angry if you happen to be someone who considers themselves a follower of Muhammad. You know, that you would be described in such a seemingly flippant way. You know, and so the challenge is being made very directly. Yeah, think about that. What's going on there? You need to really seriously sift through that issue.
Then what is the difference between Mohammedism and Islam?
Well, I mean, what tendency there is for it to not be something that's just predicated on that individual and his particular notions about militarism and females and what have you, you know, the tendency to which, you know, God is penetrating that fog in spite of the fog, you know, there's a phenomenon there that's worthy of a different label of Islam, okay? And the revelators, you know, that's why they use both words, to try to just get you to reflect on that. There's something that isn't quite so much an ism. That's more just another, you know, attempt at an evolutionary religious expression that, you know, that God is trying to do his best with. Okay, but you know, Mohammedanism is used a lot of times in the book. it's just a real difficult issue.
Yeah, again, the surrendering the decision making over to the mullah to interpret. They act like interpreters.
Right, they're the interpreters. Right? Okay, well, they're the intermediaries, you know. Right. You have a similar notion, the priest being the intermediary. But, you know, the Pope is not so much an immediate parallel. I mean, the parallel is the priest, you know. And in a historical context, you had a lot of that intermediary notion. I mean, you know, or saints too. I mean, but you know, in terms of someone who's living and standing in front of you and you can talk to, I mean, you know, there was a lot of separation between you and God with the priest stuck in between. I mean, you didn't even read the Bible directly. You know, for instance, it was in Latin, so you couldn't read it because all you knew was German or whatever. Okay, and you know, so you had to trust him. He's the only one that could actually read the sacred text. Okay, so yeah, I mean, recognize it's not some sort of bizarre, different phenomenon that's going on here in Mohammedanism. It's a very common historical thing to have this intermediary notion that you just subject yourself to.
Does Islam,
Islam has the same. Or Islam, I still don't get the difference between.
Don't try to think that there's somehow these two very separate things. I mean, it's just within this whole context of a religion, you know, that over a billion people, you know, identify with. They're just trying to point out there's sort of two phases of that. There's one side of it that's tending to be drawn out of the morass by God and might be worthy of giving, you know, when you see it wanting to move away from being this in bondage to these primitive notions, you might call that which is trying to be drawn out by God Islam. The part that isn't, you know, is just an ism.
So basically, okay, what you're saying is if you happen to come in contact with someone that believes this way, maybe first identify in your own mind, you know, have to share that with them, but, you know, which of these two, where, you know, where
is there some potential here?
Where can they go to get more God realization?
You know, for a lot of Muslims, this isn't some active sort of a thought. It's just cut and, you know, it's been inveigled, you know. They've been inveigled into this, you know. Yeah. They've all been tricked into this, you know, passive state of just never really, because, of course, see, they're just not encouraged to step back and reflect and go, wait a minute, you know. So you're, you know. Yeah, so they've just gotten caught up and on they've been going. Okay.
Don't they pray five times a day and they have certain things that they say at each section?
Yeah, right. I mean, again, we're not talking. We're not trying. Yeah. 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 The extent to which there's something that you could go, but, okay, then you're talking about a more Islam aspect of it. But just don't say, well, that's all there is. I'm going to pretend that's all there is, and I'm going to be the happy face. You know, that's the problem. The revelators are purposely not just using the word Islam. They're purposely using the other so that you don't use your spiritual eye to look at the issue. Okay. Now, the extent to which any religion is really only an ism, like Buddhism, see, there's a problem there. You know, an ism about Buddha. You know, remember, Revelators spent a lot of time talking about that, how it just, you know, the actual Buddha, you know, Gautama Siddhartha, you know, would just cringe at the ism that's become what he started, you know. You know, it's just it's an ism about him, about Buddha.
It's Buddhist religion.
Yeah. You know, again, you know, it's not, but there's a problem there, see, that it's gotten very ismized. You know, but God is always trying to draw something out of the ism, you know, so they're always, you know, you can start to, like they mentioned, you can start to get the notion of Amida Buddha, you know, in Japan. It can, you know, God is slowly over the centuries, that's, you know, one of the things they talk about when they talk about Buddhism, how in spite of all that ism, God is slowly drawing a true religious consciousness out of that ism, you know, but it's a very painful, slow process. Because it's so fundamentally not personal, the ism that you're dealing with. So it's hard to draw a personal God out of an impersonalism. Okay? It's not as hard to draw a truer religious notion out of Mohammedanism because, I mean, you've got a personal God notion. Yeah.
When my family, my grandparents, when they came here from Lebanon and all the Muslims were there, and they were Christians, and they decided to leave Lebanon to come here to be able to practice their religion of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Why did they, if it was getting away from the rigorous moral standards of that? I don't understand.
But again, you know, notice how you started that whole little thought. You started by using the word Muslim.
Yeah.
That's not being talked about here. We're not talking about Muslims here. We're talking about Mohammedans at best, and Mohammedanists, you know, more likely. Okay, we're not talking about Muslims, you know, those, I mean, okay, who are, where there's, you know, again, let's not go on, you know, we can't spend a whole night talking about Islam here, okay? Right? But just, I want to, you know, just that's the only point they're trying to make. Nowhere here they bring up Islam. This isn't a paragraph that's trying to talk about all religious thought. They're just trying to make a few key points. Notice the key point that, you know, how much do they say about Christianity? Not a lot. Okay, they're not trying to say everything. They're just trying to draw a few key points out, and it's just interesting to note what they drew out And remember the point, we're about to get to the point. The point is not to talk about all these different religions here. You see, that's not the point. You haven't gotten to the point yet. Okay? You know, if you fixate on the facts, you never get to the truth. Okay? You want to get to the truth here. But notice how they're trying to set it up. What facts are they laying out in front of you to set up some desired recognition of truth on your part? Okay? I mean, basically, they're pointing out the things that are pretty boat anchor in all these different things. I mean, if your whole notion is a promised freedom from suffering, that's it, okay? Or if your whole notion is, you know, a promise of, you know, freedom, you know, salvation from sin, or, you know, whatever. I mean, if it's all just about sin or suffering or, you know, difficulties or, okay, ugliness. I mean, that's a pretty circumscribed notion. If that's the biggie, it's going to be hard to take that very far, even with the full power of God drawing on it. Okay, that's a big boat anchor. All right. Okay, now the religion of Jesus is salvation from self. Deliverance from the evils of creature isolation in time and in eternity. Okay, But just I wanted to, you know, just notice one technical thing because it already came up tonight. Evil. Notice how they're using the word evil there, not in a way that you might have a tendency from your historical evolutionary religious perspective to use the word evil. The evils of creature isolation in time and eternity. In other words, the lack of the individual's relationship with unity. Okay? Hence the isolation. Okay? That's just at the core what evil is. It's just it's that lack of unity likeness. Okay? Yeah, I did.
In order to interpret this with self-control as that third part, we can now connect and not be isolated.
Just notice the only point they're trying to make is nothing too profound. It's just very simple statement of fact. A self is an individual. It's not unity. It's an individuation. A self is an individuation. Fundamentally, it doesn't matter how much you might pretend that your self is unity. It's not. It's an individuation. It's individuality. Okay? You need salvation from pure individuality. You need to be more than just a self. You need to be a personal self. Okay? A self, like they said up here, that, you know, individual seeks to identify the self with the universe. Okay? The only way that you can do that is to make that self a personal self. This distinction is vital for in a cosmic system. Okay. You have to make it personal so that it can have a connection to the cosmos. Okay? And you can't just magically snap your fingers and make the whole thing personal. It's a long process of slowly taking that animal origin self and taking the highest aspects of it and definitively realityizing it, making those parts of the self live in the temple. You know, the personal self dwells in the temple within. The animal origin self dwells below. And you're trying to draw more and more of it up there. The extent to which you've drawn part of it up into the temple, that part will survive your mortal life. The part that hasn't made it up there dies. Okay? Only what you get inside is what's copied and survives. Okay? But it just the process begins again when you start up in the next life. Of taking that Marantia self and more personalizing it and identifying it with the harmony of the cosmos, so that it's upheld by the mother, you know, literally, so it's connected with the mother. Yeah.
When they talk about creature isolation, they mean creature isolation from God.
from everything. I mean, it starts with God, you know, and it descends until it's everything. That's called iniquity. When you're isolated from everything in the cosmos, you know, you've bubbled yourself off so that you're unreal. Okay, now it's an iniquitous state. But it started with cutting yourself off with God. I mean, that's why the first principle of the Lutheran Manifesto, he says, you know, I want you all to follow me. First step, step one, sever yourself to the notion of God. Okay? And, you know, and then we'll work from there. You know, it's going to go really great if you start with that step. You'll be free at last. You know, all of that, you know, do this, do that stuff, you know. Who made you my boss? You know, okay.
This man who committed the terrible murders at the Virginia Tech, it seemed like this was a person who was just totally absorbed with self.
Yeah, which is part of why it's so sad to record. I mean, what's that sentence about? It's sad to record that so few persons have any significant personalized self. By and large, it's all just this animal origin self walking around on the planet. Well, and that means there's going to be a tail, you know, where you really start to see the sadness, you know, in real time, very definitively. You know, you get too far away from, you know, if you diminish that aspect of yourself that is personalized far enough, you know, you're going to fall off the other end, okay? It's going to be very sad for all involved.
Explain a little bit more what you mean by personalized.
Yeah, it fundamentally, see, what is your personality doing? It's, you know, it's coordinating harmony in the self system. Self is an energy system that needs to be harmonized. It doesn't come pre-harmonized. It doesn't come pre-like the cosmos. It's as far removed from that as possible and still having it harmonizable, as a matter of fact. Okay? So it's nothing but work to do when you start. You just got to start on square one and work on harmonizing it. Go to square two, work on harmonizing it. Now that's just a word. But that's part of what the revelation is about. It's revealing the nature of the cosmos so that you can begin to figure out what harmony means. What does cosmos mean? What am I trying to do here? Can't I just have faith? Well, yes, to get started. But, you know, this life is pretty short. I mean, you know, if you want to think beyond 80-year time spans, you might want to try to, you know, get a little bigger picture in mind, you know. All you have to do is have a faith grasp, a faint flicker at that to start. But, you know, aren't you interested about why you're starting? I mean, what's it all about? What am I trying to do here? If you believe that at the end of this life, you gain everything, you know, if through the process of death you gain everything, well, then, okay, then such notions are irrelevant. What's one of those? It's item number 23 in the list of 28 in the Marantia Moda section.
Death added nothing.
Yeah, death added nothing. Eh?
Yeah.
Death added nothing. You know, that's in complete contrast. You know, humans that have some notion of a heaven, they think death adds everything. You die and boink, you're standing right there in the presence of the infinite. It adds infinite. No, it adds nothing. Okay. Yeah. It's like, wow, that's really different. I see the truth in that. I can live that difference. Yeah. I mean, do you see the truth that flows through that? You know, number 23 there in the list. That should change the way you live your life. You know, if you think that all I have to have is just a faint flicker of faith, you know, and then the magic takes care of the rest, how are you going to live your life? Not with a lot of internal challenge towards higher nature. You're going to cruise along the bottom. Okay? Did the little baptism thing. I'm set. That's bottom feed.
No survival value.
Yeah. Okay. That's the way most people's lives is predicated on, even if they have a religious consciousness. You know, it's just so limited. No, you're beginning a mind-boggling journey, a journey that's climbing a mountain that's so much higher than humans have ever imagined. It is so high, the mountain between here and paradise. It's so high that you can't even see the summit, when you land on Havona. It still seems to be a mountain without a top.
Okay. Just the way it did when I started.
Right. Nothing's changed. I've just spent all this time. And it's the same. It's still, I can't even remotely see where I'm heading. What the? They tell you, finally you get to Vona. Now your actual spiritual climb begins.
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome to base camp.
You had to develop perfection and purpose by that point. Give up, you'd go the
other way. Right. The fact that you land and you open your eyes and you still can't even, if you didn't have perfection of purpose, you'd give up. And so, the revelation is trying to give us this big picture so that, we eliminate all the magic at death. And there's nothing that happens there. Death is a nothing. Okay? It's not everything, it's nothing. Death is nothing. Okay, you just go right through it.
Yeah. Basically, personal self means that you're trying to harmonize with your personality.
No, you're trying to use your personality to harmonize yourself. Self is not self-harmonizing. Third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, the self is self-harmonizing.
Okay.
Right? Personality is choosing to, remember, we the personal self stands here in the temple. The not yet personalized self is over here. The cosmos is over here. The personal self, you're given a tiny little measure of personal self by grace so that you can stand here. Okay? And that personal self can look at, the 99.999999% of the self that isn't personal yet. Okay? And it can look at the cosmos and go, wow, I've got my work cut out for me. Let's start. Now, this is not harmony. That's harmony. I've got to work on this. And every amount that I harmonize that self, it now lives in here with the little nugget that was started by grace. That initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit by grace, that initial linkage to the Father by grace. Okay. Just the smallest amount that you've been given to get it started. You have everything you need to get it started, but not one drop more. Everything else you have to choose.
Like a yeast cell.
Right. Yeah, one yeast cell. Right. It's worse than a mustard seed. Okay? Yeah, right. Because they didn't know about the microscopic.
To internalize it, to make it personal in the unselfish way, then we can make the right choice and, identity.
I mean, initially, just the self can discover something, but only the personal self can recognize anything. The animal origin self has no ability to recognize. Only the personal self can recognize. And it's got the three cosmic recognitions, okay? The three, and then now we have a fourth recognition facet, the Spirit of Truth, and then, you're going to interpret in that, and we're going to get to that in the true reason domain, not just the animal origin reason domain. And then that personal self is going to choose. Yeah. So self and lack of unity. So that's where they left us. Now they're going to give us a couple other little fact points of evolutionary religion.
The Hebrews based their religion on goodness, the Greeks on beauty. Both religions sought truth. Jesus revealed a God of love, and love is all-embracing of truth, beauty, and goodness.
Okay, just one little thing to notice. We've talked a lot about bidirectional flows. I know that I've got beauty here, truth here, goodness here. So the Hebrews started with goodness and were trying to penetrate down into truth. And the Greeks started with beauty and were trying to extend up into truth. But neither of them could complete the circuit. Right? See, neither could complete the circuit because, you know, there's not just two blocks, these two or these two. There's three blocks. It's a threefold actuality. You need all three. So what did Jesus do? He said, well, okay, each of you have got half the picture. What can I give you to help you to put the two pictures together? Okay. Well, if I got you to really bring in that other thing, that God is thing, you had God is personality, you had God is spirit, you had God is law. How about God is love? If I get you to bring in God is love, love overarches truth, beauty, and goodness. It's in the context of love that you have all three. And you can free yourself from the limitations of the Hebrew half and the Greek half, the top-down half and the bottom-up half.
Love is personal.
Okay? So that's what they're trying to bring in there. All right, next.
The Zoroastrians had a religion of morals. The Hindus, a religion of metaphysics. The Confucianists, a religion of ethics. Jesus lived a religion of service. All these religions are of value in that they are valid approaches to the religion of Jesus. Religion is destined to become the reality of the spiritual unification of all that is good, beautiful, and true in human experience.
So in other words, it's like all these things are different parts of the elephant. So you notice how they're laying out? I've got all these different... You know, one is holding the tail, one's holding the trunk, one's, okay, it's the old elephant story, okay? And notice those last two sentences, okay? If I lay out all of the religions, wouldn't it be a nice, really condensed way to put all the religions in front of me so I could think about them? Every religion has a symbol. What if I put each of those symbols in a line and I put it on a bumper sticker? Okay. You know, we've talked about this before. What they're, you know, they're talking about the coexist bumper sticker here. Basically, what they're talking about are, yeah, they're talking about each of those symbols. Okay, and what do they say? Is the answer in just believing in the sequence of symbols? No. What does it say? All these religions are of value in that they are valid approaches to the religion of Jesus. Religion is destined to become the reality of the spiritual unification of all that is good, beautiful, and true in human experiences. You take each of what those, each part of the elephant that one of those symbols represents, and you go up. And what's the word? Unification. You take the threads of truth that are attempting to free themselves from the boat anchor that each of those symbols has. You liberate it from the boat anchor. You bring it up and you bring it together. Okay. They only have value. All those religions only have value in that they are valid approaches to the religion of Jesus. Okay. A starting point, an evolutionary starting point. Okay, and what is that fundamentally? Before we bring in these two paragraphs, they've had the two words. Remember, if you go up into the epical revelations, and they say Jesus of Nazareth. What are the two italicized words there that they say are the essential teachings of Jesus?
Love and service.
Love and service. Right? What word is italicized in this paragraph?
Service.
And what did they say in the previous paragraph? God is love. Right? Okay. Love and service. That's the key. Okay. You liberate all these frozen starting points. Liberate them. You shall know the truth, and the truth will set each of those religions free from their boat anchor. They can come together as one. But notice how, if you tell a devout religionist of one of these flavors that the only value of what they're up to is that it's a valid approach to the religion of Jesus, and they have some simplistic notion of what Jesus represents, okay? So you've got to liberate the religion of Jesus from its bondage. It'd be nice if we had something that spent a third of its pages doing that. Okay. And then, you know, we got to do this. You know, and that, you know, this doesn't, you know, the part four of this book doesn't change the fact of Christianity. Christianity is one in this list here, see. You know, it has a boat, particular flavor of boat anchor that it has to be liberated from too, just like all the others. It's, in that sense, it's no better than the other. All those symbols, that's the value of that. Of that, you know, all the symbols are on the same line. Yeah. The basement. Okay. Line one, you know. Yep.
On 1575, we don't have to talk about it all, but there's four examples, four supreme reactions of fatherly love. And I thought that would be important to say.
Yeah, and that's coming up here in the list, kind of. You know, you'll see that brought up. Right. I mean, we know that which is of greatest, you know, value, you know, of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value. Right. We know it's building to that. Yeah. All right. Yep. Oh, you got anything?
Speaking about these the different religion, don't you think it's interesting that when people in the former world religions have gotten together and tried to really figure out what it was that they had in common, and what they've come up with is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man.
If you know, the extent to which you can get a subset of each of the religions identifying with that, you know, it's progress. You know, but the problem is they're boat anchors. You know, you got a handful of people who are ready to free themselves, to follow the truth, and be truly free, but they're attached to all those that don't have that desire. You know, and so that's why those, the interfaith, you know, the ecumenical movement has, you know, has always been fraught with so much difficulty.
But doesn't it indicate that people are hungry for something more?
It indicates there's a God, too. See, you know, that's the thing. You know, see, that's the thing. I mean, we know that God, you know, there's spirit gravity. God has a hold of all this stuff and is pulling up on it. But we have absolute free will. Even though that spirit gravity has an absolute center, you know, the eternal Son, okay, we have absolute free will. You know, and until we choose, discover, recognize, interpret, and choose, until we choose to cut the tether to that boat anchor, that spirit gravity can't take it. That's, you know, the spirit gravity, we can look around and we can see people who are being pulled up above a lot of the others. But, you know, do you notice that there's still elastic bands attached to the bottom of them? That's the problem. You know? Okay.
It's the bungee group.
You know? Until they, you know, have the courage to snip those bonds and no longer see themselves as a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or a whatever, you know, there's a limit to how far we can go. Yep.
I just thought it would be a good idea to, instead of saying the religion of Jesus, because that's kind of a dogma in some religions, is to say the religion of love and service. To other people, it's a huge turnoff.
But just notice, do they use the word Jesus in part four of the book? Be careful about letting your spiritual consciousness have the final say in this reflection on what's going on here. I mean, don't fuzz Jesus out. Right. I mean, they're trying to point out, you know, that you don't need to stop saying Jesus. You need to get people to recognize the true Jesus.
Right. Spirit of truth.
You know, until...
How often have they heard that?
That's why it's... I was trying to point out the way that's worded. See, it says... Valid approaches to the religion of Jesus, a very purpose. It doesn't say approaches to Jesus. You know, it is the religion of Jesus. Okay. But see, again, that requires very precise thought. You know, the person you're talking to has to be able to distinguish between Jesus and the religion of Jesus. If they can't do that, okay.
Next.
Okay. it has to be someone with at least that much sophistication of thought. Is they're going, well, Jesus said, you know, it's all blurred together and, you know, it's a bunch of blowing.
mean, there's no soil there.
Nothing to work with there.
Nothing to work with there. You know, and the answer is like, well, okay, stop saying Jesus. No. that's not going to improve the situation. You know, the truth is they need a greater relationship to the sum and substance, you know, of Michael of Nebadon, Jesus of Nazareth. They need a relationship to the Spirit of Truth. Turning them away from the word Jesus doesn't turn them towards the Spirit of Truth. It turns them away from the Spirit of Truth. You know, what they need, what you have is effort, struggle, conflict. You have a conflict with the word Jesus. You need to overcome that conflict, not turn away from it.
That's right.
And that's going to be thousands and thousands of years.
Okay.
The Greek religion had a watchword, know yourself.
In a relaxed way.
The Hebrews centered their teaching on know your God. The Christians preach a gospel aimed at a knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus proclaimed the good news of knowing God and yourself as a son of God. These differing concepts of the purpose of religion determine the individual's attitude in various life situations and foreshadow the depth of worship and the nature of his personal habits of prayer. The spiritual status of any religion may be determined by the nature of its prayers. The concept of a semi-human and jealous God as an inevitable transition between is an inevitable transition between polytheism and sublime monotheism. An exalted anthropomorphism is the highest attainment level of purely evolutionary religion. Christianity has elevated the concept of anthropomorphism from the ideal of the human to the transcendent and divine concept of the person of the glorified Christ. And this is the highest anthropomorphism that man can ever conceive.
Okay. So let's look at those two things they're doing there. Again, they're trying to give you this, you know, kind of a little sense of what Jesus tried to do, and you know what we've got in place so far from Jesus. So you start again. We've got the Greeks and the Hebrews being contrasted. Know yourself, or, you know, we all know thyself. You know, it's often how it's said. Know yourself and know your God. Okay, what does Jesus do? You know, forget about the Christians there. We'll get to that in a second. But just notice what Jesus did with that again. He said Jesus proclaimed the good news of knowing God and yourself as the Son of God. He put those two together. How did he do it? You know, he did it with a personal God who's your Father, hence you're a Son of God. That's how he put those two together. Okay, see, that's what the technique he was using. He was trying to take those two very fertile soils and show people how they come together, or get them to put them together without them even realizing that's what they're doing in some ways. Okay? Right? Yeah. Right? See, both of them are there, knowing God and yourself. The key is just is the linkage part. You know, why he preached God as your Father. See, so that you could have not just knowing God and yourself, but as a Son of God. See, he could add that so that they're linked together. Okay, and then as you can see, like they brought out in that second paragraph, you've got the full thing about, you know, the Christian approach. You know, Christians preach a gospel aimed at knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, the exaltation of Christ. Then they explain that. You know, what's the issue there when you think about that in the whole evolutionary context? Okay, so. You're going from polytheism, trying to get to a sublime monotheism. See, an exalted anthropomorphism is the highest attainment level of purely evolutionary religion. Okay? So, just like biologic evolution reached its peak, and that's why Adam and Eve come to a world when biologic evolution reaches a peak. You know, see, an exalted anthropomorphism is the highest thing that you're going to get out of an evolutionary religion. And then we just now have that, you know, in spades. What are they saying? You know, we've got this. Christianity has elevated the concept of anthropomorphism, okay, from the ideal of the human to the transcendent divine concept of the person of the glorified Christ. Okay, so in other words, what we have right now is the highest anthropomorphism possible, and anthropomorphism is the highest thing possible with evolutionary religion. There is nowhere to go anymore. Okay? You're at the highest peak that any evolutionary religion on any planet can ever achieve. Okay? So, those symbols, they can't go up themselves anymore. They just told you. They're plateaued. The whole system is plateaued. There's only one way for it to go up. You know, you've got to bring in revealed religion, revelatory religion. You have to choose. You have to discover, recognize, interpret, and choose what we've got here in the clarification of the fourth and the fifth epical revelation, you know, and choose to upstep those. They will not be drawn up any further. God has pulled them up as far as God can pull them up. You know, now it's up to us to choose. If they're going to go up any higher, it'll be as a consequence of our choice to snip what's holding us back. You know, it's not, you know, it's, they aren't going to go up anymore because God has turned spiritual gravity off. That's not why they're not going to go up anymore. Spiritual gravity can't be turned off. It's in full force, but it can't go up any further. Okay?
Yeah, it's up against
the because world. We've reached the fullness of an animal origin self that is pulled up.
The mother's done as much as she can do.
Everything else, you know, is done by choice. That's why you were given a gift from the Father. Yeah. Now, there, it's not like, you know, you then make that choice and then you jump all the way up to paradise. You know, you choose to exist in a bigger domain, and then you're drawn up to the ceiling of that domain, and then you choose to exist in a yet bigger domain, and you're drawn up to the ceiling of that. Okay, but we can't be drawn up anymore. We're pinned against the ceiling right now.
Okay. Can you give us some examples of those choices?
Well, I mean, that was what I was trying to point out. I mean, that's what they've basically done. They've given you, for each religion, they've given you the key thing that you need to choose. You need to let go of, say, a fixation on morals or ethics or metaphysics or sin or, you know, suffering or, you know, those are all boat anchors.
The concept of knowing God and yourself as a son of God is, in potential, will take us all the way to paradise.
Yeah.
In process, we have to, as we know God more, then, and ourselves as sons of God, mm-hmm. we can fill that space. It's a continual process of expansion.
Yeah. And in a simple little example along the lines you're thinking of, you've heard me try to turn something on its head. You know, a few years back, you know, everyone was wearing little bracelets that had letters on it. Do you remember what they were? W, right? All right. What would Jesus do? Okay. No. What would a child of God do? Put that question in your head. So just like Gene is saying, you know, you come up, the next thing that, you know, that requires a decision in your life, don't ask what would Jesus do, okay? In order to go up, we need to ask a better question than that. We need to ask, what would a child of God do? What would someone who knows God and themselves as a son of God do? Not what would Jesus do?
And a brother to other men.
Right, of course, you know, if you're right. I mean that's the corollary. And so when another person is involved, that's what brings that other person fundamentally into play. It's like, well, if I'm a child of God and God is a universal father, then that's a child of God, that's a child of God, that's a child of God. So you start with what would a child of God do, and then when you get into a personal interaction, it's what would a child of God do relating to another child of God. You can take it up a notch. Jason?
I also see here that it's talking about how they venerated Jesus instead of his teaching.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's... I mean, you know, they've elevated the concept of anthropomorphism. See, that's focusing on Jesus, you know, rather than on the religion of Jesus.
Right.
See, yeah, that's the whole point. And think about how that, you know, the spiritual status of any religion may be determined by the nature of its prayers. Don't just think of the obvious there of, yeah, if they're talking, you know, if they're only praying for material things, that shows you there's not a lot of spiritual status in play. That's obvious. But you know, again, is it a prayer that someone who knows God and themselves as a son of God would pray? Or is it someone who, you know, just believes in Jesusism or something? You know, I mean, is it all very Flatlander sort of like prayer? I mean, how much vertical character does this prayer have? Let alone how much spirit does it have instead of just matter, you know, in play? How much are you praying for unity as opposed to greater measures of individuality, you know, or having your individuality be better than it is now, or, you know, I mean, you know, is it just a prayer about individuality instead of unity? You know, yeah. But also, once there's an element of unity in that prayer, how much verticality is in that prayer? How much of a sense of the vertical dimension of reality, a relationship to the ascension scheme, does that prayer have? Are you praying in that context, seeing yourself as that ascending Son of God? Or are you praying for horizontal things, no matter how spiritual they might be? Okay, so so now let's kind of move more into the positive. You know, we've been kind of fighting against all of this. You know, in the moment they bring up all these religions, notice how much we've been wrestling with all of this baggage that mankind has in their religious life.
The Christian concept of God is an attempt to combine three separate teachings. One, the Hebrew concept, God as a vindicator of moral values, a righteous God. Two, the Greek concept, God as a unifier, a God of wisdom. Three, Jesus concept, God as a living friend, a loving father, the divine presence.
And that's bringing in a little bit of the stuff that you were thinking about, Jason, you know, up there in the Jesus papers, you know, that full Jesus concept, you know, living friend, loving father, divine presence. You might even notice
three aspects.
Yeah, do you notice the Trinity there?
Yes.
Son, Father, Spirit.
Yes.
So it isn't just Father. The full picture is in play too. So when you think of love and, you know, yeah, there's love and service. That's the essentials, but that's not the totality. You know, so they're reminding you a little bit more of the whole picture. And that, you know, just, You notice that it immediately brings the Trinity into play.
Maybe if you introduce someone to that maybe has a little initial problem with a father being so close to them and inside their mind, you know.
Yeah, well, you did it. God is a living friend.
You introduce the living friend.
Right. And also, see, notice the attempt to deal with the isolation feeling, you know, by immediately reminding you there's a divine presence. You're immersed in a divine presence. You're not in a vacuum like the scientists tell you. You're not in a vacuum. You're bathed in a divine presence. You know, there's no magic that is going to bring that presence within. You need to choose to bring it in, but it's right there. You don't have to journey. It's right there.
Chris, I would beg to say that in the Lord's Prayer, the four supreme reactions of fatherly love are in them.
That would be, you know, so if you're going to say, well, okay, exactly how did Jesus try to lead me in this regard? Like, for instance, prayer. Oh, yeah, there is that Lord's Prayer thing, and it has been restored to its proper form. I could reflect on that. Yeah, I mean, see, yeah, that's the whole point. You know, start with things like that. Reflect on it. And see if you can see, like we were just doing, noticing how he had this, you know, this sneaky idea in mind. It's like, you know, we can take that Greek thing and we can take that, you know. Notice how, you know, start thinking about the things he said and think about his ulterior motives, you know, what he's trying to kind of get them to do without them, you know, without approaching him in a very technical, philosophical fashion. You know, I mean, he's trying to do it where even the common man is going to do what needs to be done.
Okay.
So you got those three things, and obviously a lot of real positive possibilities in the third. All right.
It must therefore be evident that composite Christian theology encounters great difficulty in attaining consistency.
That we call understatement.
I'd say so.
This difficulty is further aggravated by the fact that the doctrines of early Christianity were generally based on the personal religious experience of three different persons: Philo of Alexandria, Jesus of Nazareth, and Paul of Tarsus.
And to a degree, you say, well, isn't that kind of just repeating what they just said in items 1, 2, and 3? I mean, you've got Jesus, and you've got the Greek, you've got Philo, and you've got the Hebrew, you've got Paul. Yes, but, you know, the reason they pointed out is there's also their particular tendencies. And you remember they point that out up in the Jesus papers, being in Jesus papers. Like, for instance, Paul. He brought a particular flavor of sin and atonement notion into the mix. You know, it's one thing to have God as a vindicator of moral values, a righteous God, you know, but then you also have Paul's particular take on some of those things.
Yeah, so. How about Jesus' particular take?
You know, that's one of the benefits of saying what would a child of God do instead of what would Jesus do, because, you know, we talk about that a lot when we're reading through the Jesus papers. You got to remember, you know, that there's more than just the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it going on here. There's also the seventh bestowal of a creator son of Nebadon, and, you know, I mean, don't confuse that part of it. The true man part, you know, is of immediate value to the true God part. I guess, okay, you're not going to do creator things. And again, it says, they're just trying to, again, notice how they're again just trying to remind you of all these little anchor points that could be holding you back, you know, in a particular religious tradition. Now, and it's pretty complicated in Christianity. There's a whole bunch of subtle things that, see, are woven in that are going to have to be consciously recognized, you know, and a choice is going to have to be made by Christians to let go of all these this multifaceted anchor system. You know, a number of other religions aren't as complicated. That's why they're saying this. You know, they're saying, you know, is therefore evident. You know, okay, this is a composite religion, and so it's going to take quite a bit of active recognition to sift through all that. It's like, oh, that's holding me back, and that's holding me back, and that. You know? Whereas if I'm in another tradition, I just need to stop being so circumscribed, where I'm trying to make one tiny little thought, you know, a complete lifestyle solution. Yeah. You know, Christians are trying to make a whole bunch of thoughts that don't really come together very well. A complete lifestyle solution is very complicated. Yeah.
In recent years, it seems like the so-called, I don't know if it's theologians, but biblical scholars have been trying to ferret out what really is of Jesus in the Bible, rather than all the other things that are there.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's basically impossible, of course, you know. That's why we have so much of part four of the book. I mean, you know, because none of that was written by Jesus. You know, it was all written by people who processed it through their worldview. You know, Luke processed it through his worldview and tainted it. And Paul, you know, like we're just talking. You know?
Yeah. There needs to be brakes on those runaway trains. And I think God the Mother gives us the brake system back.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't even really talked about how, especially in more modern times, there are a lot of individuals in some of these traditions who have gotten a vague sense that there's something that's holding them back. They've decided what they need to be is a free thinker. We all know how about the Revelator specifically address that, because again, there's this tendency, either you're in bondage and you don't recognize it to these boat anchors, or you finally kind of recognize that something's holding you back, and you say, well, what I need is no form. I need to just cast off all grounding. And and so they swing all, they see the world in dichotomies. Yeah, everyone sees them. So they swing all the way the other direction, which, is obviously not an improvement. And of course, the thing is that actually is worse. I mean, it's actually not, we've talked about this because, if you cast off all form as a response to bondage to a false form, then everything's going, then civilization's going to unravel. Everything's going to unravel. You'll have anarchy and just chaos, and it'll just all fall apart. And it's bad enough, that part of it, the civilizational part of it. Never mind how, if you take your spiritual consciousness and decide that spiritual consciousness doesn't need form, that it's innately divine. It doesn't need to be molded, purposed, directed. That's when the revelators use the word danger, of course. Yeah. So, its problem is it's not too great to have everything so in bondage. There's not a lot of civilizational or personal danger in play. It's just painfully slow, and the poor progress angels are going, but there's a reason why the angels of the churches are called the checkmates, the progress angels. Okay, I mean, and it's because of this. I mean, yes, it's slow, painfully slow. Yes, but remember what's over here. Over here is great personal danger. And the collapse of civilization, they're not just the checks. Notice it's not a check and balance system between those two groups of angels. The angels of progress are not checks to the angels of the churches, and the angels of the churches are not just checks to the angels of progress. They're checkmates. Okay, I'm not going to just check you. I'm going to mate you. Okay, we're not doing even one measure of that, because that, is catastrophic. Yeah, they're checkmates.
it's very, very difficult for anybody who's studied the Revelation to try to put things in perspective, you just want to dash out and beat people over the head with a book.
I mean, you know, and just think about what I was just pointing out. You know, you got these master seraphim. If you go out there and you actually are quite adept and really start, you know, getting a whole bunch of stuff moving, but it's not in a stable context, you're going to get checkmated. Okay, I mean, you know, those angels of churches are going to checkmate you just like they'll checkmate the angels of progress. Okay, you going down? Yeah, that's not going to happen. Because you're going to do more harm than good. You know, with the best of intentions, you're going to just create chaos. So, you know, there's been all kinds of frustrated idealists, you know, who think that they're the source of their frustration is some human or some institution or something. You know, if they're really effective and not just, you know, think they are, the checkmate is most likely an angel of some sort, okay? You know, that's what's been revealed to us now. You know, the angels are just, you know, all over that sort of stuff. Not only, you know, shutting you down if you're going to be problematic, but, you know, bringing difficulties into your life if, if things are getting too easy, yeah.
You're on an infinite loop there.
Here, just use those spiritual tweezers on yourself.
Yep. So, you know, and just, you know, in all of that, just, I mean, Jason has a good point. Remember, you know, always start with yourself. But to, you know, to make sure that when you read stuff like about the angels in the book, you don't just approach those statements factually. You know, think about the truth that flows. Okay, how does that fact change the way I live my life? If I follow the truth that flows through that fact, how is that different than the truth that I've been following? And we'll assume that it actually was truth and not error. But, you know, let's say you were following truth, but it's going to be a tiny little capillary tube of truth. Okay? And you need to try to get a little bit bigger flow of truth that you're synchronized with. Okay? And it's going to change everything. You know, if you go beyond the capillary tube, it's going to, you know, that's the way truth is. Changes everything. You got to have the courage to let everything change. How is my life going to be different knowing that there's checkmates, for instance? You might, you know, be a little bit more reflective in advance. You might actually do what they just said at the beginning of this thing. Maybe you'll work on getting the mind to be harmonious like the cosmos before you start willing it somewhere. Yeah. Right? I mean, that's always the problem, you know, with idealism. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's because you're putting the cart before the horse. You know, you're willing that which is not harmonious, you know, and that's either just going to be really messy or it could be really serious, and then you're going to bring an angel down on you to checkmate you, okay? You know, or even worse, maybe the Most High Observer will have to assume regency in order to clean up your mess. You know, I mean, if it's really bad.
A lot of it might be specifically on readers of the book, because we're the ones that are wielding this elevated power. I mean, if we get to a certain level, you know, it's just. Like,
I mean, again, you know, you don't want to go, you know, start right. trying to, you know, right. see angels behind every, you know, tweak, you know, but. But just, you know that that's in play. I mean, it should bring in a little bit of humility, a little bit of patience here.
A lot of reflection. Yeah.
Because especially if I'm going really fast, if they're going to stop me, that hurts. I know the faster I'm driving the car, if I hit a wall, it hurts more the faster I'm driving. Okay? I mean, you know, so just remind yourself of that, you know. The faster you go, if you're not on the right path, when they stop you, it's going to hurt more.
We can make progress and still not grow. And why is that?
Right, that's true. I mean, you know, there
that
that's an important thing to remember about the difference between so-called progress and true progress. You know, is it progress that results from growth? You know, it's got to be top-down. It has to be perfecting spirit, and that perfecting spirit has to give rise to progressing mind. Okay, growth gives rise to progress, you know, or development. It needs to be in that order. You know, and they remind you that it goes all the way down, you know, to the bottom level where there's change. Change without growth is potential evil. You know, reminding you that it has to be fundamentally top down. Growth has to lead to progress. Progress has to lead to adaptation, and adaptation has to lead to change. You know, and we all know this is a huge problem. We have all these spiritual consciousness that wants to start changing things, but it's bottom up. You know, it hasn't come down through all those stages. You know, and that's why, you know, this potential of evil is being actualized all over the place. You know, all this change is actualizing as evil, you know, because it's change without growth. You know, it's not change that's predicated on a cosmic consciousness. It's just predicated on the desire for perfection, you know. And if we just turn all these knobs and change everything, you know, no, you're going to make things so much worse, you know. Okay, so let's wrap it up here.
In the study of the religious life of Jesus, view him positively. Think not so much of his sinlessness as of his righteousness, his loving service. Jesus upstepped the passive love disclosed in the Hebrew concept of the Heavenly Father to the higher active and creature-loving affection of a God who is the Father of every individual, even of the wrongdoer.
Yeah, and you know that even that last phrase is there in Christianity, but notice that they made a point of stressing it again. Because all of those of us who have come out of Christianity need to recognize that we're going to have an initial tendency to not remember that. you notice how they're speaking. You know, again, this is in the context of, you know, we've just been reading about Christianity. You know, they're saying to Christians, you know, what did they say? They said that Christianity promises salvation from sin. Okay, you know, in the study of the religious life of Jesus, view him positively. Think not so much of his sinlessness. Yeah. So in other words, sin is the complete lifestyle solution. You know, everything is about sin, you know, and sinlessness. You know, it's this fixation on sin. You know, but bringing back in that Hebrew righteousness, but clarifying it, you know, his loving service. Okay, so, you know, they're speaking very much to that Christian evolutionary pretext here. And so in speaking in that mode, they chose to put that little parenthetical on there, even of the wrongdoer. They're saying, remember that that's always been a challenge for you. And the primary reason is because you've had so much fixation on sin, even though you'll give lip service to even of the wrongdoer, you keep stumbling over that because you're so fixated on the sin thing. Okay? All of us who are trying to free ourselves from that historical, you know, evolutionary religion pretext, you know, they're speaking to us too. Catch yourself wanting to still come up with just, you know, do a new wine and old wineskins things where those wrongdoers are still not of the body. You know, you really, really want them to be out in the cold. Because you just don't like them, you know, and if the old Christian, you know, tendencies of finding a way to put those wrongdoers out in the cold, you know, is not going to be allowed by the Urantia book anymore. Well, I'm going to dream up a new Urantia book centric notion of getting them out in the cold, because I want them to pay for what they've done to me somehow.
That kind of gave me relief thinking that way. You know, they've got to punish them.
Right. It's always giving humans relief, you know. That's why we've taken that thought so far, you know, to having all kinds of complex notions about hell and all this sort of stuff, you know, so we can have this whole domain about, you know, them getting their due. Those wrongdoers, you know, we love to talk about the wrongdoers and how wrong they're doing, you know, and how life would be so much better if there weren't those evil wrongdoers over there and those evil wrongdoers.
And I wanted to see it now. Yeah.
Right, and you want to see it happen in your lifetime. You know, it's not satisfying to think about it just happening in the next life. You know, you want it to happen now. You know, so you want to pass laws to punish those wrongdoers, and you want to, you know, I mean, it's that whole fixation on sin. Now, of course, you know, wrongdoer, evildoer is one thing. Now, there is, you know, in that same mode. See, again, don't go all the way the other direction. Don't think that there isn't something that you might have to deal with. Those are sin doers. Right. The difference between an evildoer, a wrongdoer, and a sin doer, yeah, a sinful, okay, you know, that's, you can't overcome sin with good.
Right.
So, you know, so you flip it to the other side, and, you know, it's still complicated, okay? You know, you may still have to bomb someone,
yeah,
because it's not an act of evil, it's an act of sin. Okay, but of course, if you're gonna have to do that, if somebody's gonna have to die, you know, if there's gonna have to be capital punishment or war, you know, that can't be a personal thing. You need to have a non-personal expression of a group. You know, you need a government, you know, to do that. Okay, so all that stuff comes into the picture. But that's, you know, not the main point. The main point is just to notice that of all the things they could have slipped in there, they slipped that little thing in,
yeah,
to make sure that you're thinking about, yeah, that. God loves, you can be very, very sinful, and God loves, still loves you exactly the same as he loves the most devout person on the planet. The only thing that changes, it's not the magnitude of sin. The only thing that changes God's relationship to that individual is if they go to iniquity. It's a binary system. It's absolute love or nothing. Why is it nothing? Because there's nothing there to love. An iniquitous person is a nothing. Okay? If there's the tiniest something, that tiny something is loved exactly the same as the biggest divine counselor, the eternal. I mean, there's no difference between how God loves the eternal Son and how he loves the most sinful person that's ever lived on this planet if they weren't iniquitous. There's no difference. Because there can't be. Because if there was a difference, then God wouldn't be absolute. God would be relative. God isn't relative. God's absolute.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me why you can't overcome sin with goodness.
Okay, just why? Because sin, you know, if it's actual sin, not so-called sin, you know, we love to call lots of things sins that aren't, but actual sin, deliberate disloyalty to deity, okay, what does that mean? That if it's deliberate disloyalty to deity, to unity, that means you objectively, clearly see that which is good and that which is bad. And then you choose that which is bad because it's not good. Sin is a choice consciously of that which is bad. Okay, so let's see. Could I overcome that with good? Let me pour a whole bunch of good in front of them. And they're going, good, 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 bad. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if there's one good thing or 5,000 good things in front of them. They're consciously rejecting that which is good in favor of that which is bad. You can't overcome sin with goodness. That's why the book never says that. Because that's illogical.
And Jesus.
Sin is an act, it's a deliberate disloyalty to deity, to unity. You know, what do you, you know, that's the person is saying, this, you know, he clearly sees that this augments relationship to unity, yeah, and this disrupts relationship to unity. That's why he's choosing it. Yeah. It doesn't matter how much more relationship to unity you part in front of him. You can't overcome sin with good. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, you know, that's why that's so important, that remember that, you know, you must redefine the word sin. Be that deliberate, disloyalty. If you have any other notion of what sin is, nothing will make sense in this book. It'll all be, you know, you'll just be putting new wine in old wine.
Because
so the best.
Instead of God,
you have
loving,
to redefine that.
Loving the sinner but hating the sin,
which is also illogical, technically. See?
He loves,
right?
He loves the evildoer.
Okay.
But
I mean, he even loves the sinner.
Yeah.
See.
Until it's iniquity.
Right. He can't love the iniquitous person because there's nothing there to love. It's not real.
As far as having a hate for the sin, that's ascribing a spirit word for
it's a personal word to personal. A personal word to a non-personal thing. Remember, that's
the
point
about
that they make.
Hate when people use hate.
Right.
Yeah. Now
you can't,
left, so
right. Yeah. Never mind that. But technically, not even you can hate sin because sin is not a person. And hate is a personal act. Okay. All right. Let's take a moment here and reflect on it.